Welcome to the Lutheran Education Podcast, brought to you by Lutheran Special Education Ministries. In this podcast, we'll explore trends, issues, and events surrounding Lutheran education. In each episode, we'll invite educational experts to shed light on topics that support educators, administrators, and staff. Thank you for listening to LSEM's Lutheran Education Podcast.
Welcome to the Lutheran Education Podcast, brought to you by Lutheran Special Education Ministries. I am your host today. I am the Director of Programs and Services at Lutheran Special Education Ministries, and my name is Richard Schumacher. And with us today, another very familiar name on the podcast, but a new title for this familiar name this time. Dr. Kara Bratton joins us on the podcast once again. Kara, it's good to have you back.
Yep, good to be back. Thanks, Rich.
And Kara is the most humble person about this, so I really enjoy embarrassing her when it comes to these sorts of things. So we're going to start with just that, Kara. So talk to us about your doctoral degree, where you earned it from, what you earned it in. Just tell us a little bit about that process.
Sure. So I just finished, graduated with my PhD in special education leadership from Concordia University, Chicago. Not River Forest anymore, but Concordia, Chicago. Great program. Can't say enough good things about it. But again, focused really on special education and also how to be a leader in that field. And my dissertation specifically focused on principals and of Christian schools in the United States and how they develop and implement special education programs. So even that year-long process was a huge and wonderful opportunity for me to speak with not just Lutheran school principals, but other Christian school principals about how they do special education and what their challenges are. So it was a wonderful year of learning and very intense work, but I would do it over again in a heartbeat.
Excellent. And I mean, that in and of itself sounds like a topic for the podcast at some point in time, just discussing some of those differences that we see amongst other schools and how that relates to our LCMS schools that we work with and that are obviously serving kids within our synod. But as far as today goes, the topic that we're going to discuss is the idea of inclusion. And a lot of people, when you say that word, have a wide range of reactions because inclusion means a lot of things to a lot of different people. And so for the sake of just setting the table and establishing an effective definition of what inclusion means in terms of your perspective on it and how it affects Lutheran schools, let's start there. What does inclusion mean in the terms of this conversation?
Sure. So like you said, there's a lot of different interpretations when you say that word inclusion. The biggest thing I hear when you talk about inclusion is people and educators will talk about inclusion, meaning that those students, well, yeah, we do inclusion because we have students with disabilities in our school and in our classroom. So that idea that inclusion means they're physically present. And a lot of times if I talk to people, they'll say, well, yeah, that's what the public school does. They do inclusion. And maybe they do to an extent, but there again, that definition of inclusion talks about, well, the law says that they need to be physically present in the classrooms for the majority of their school day. But for our purposes, and really if you read about inclusion and what researchers and what experts in the field mean when they say inclusion, they're really talking about more than that physical presence. They're really talking about two things. The first component is really, some will call it a sense of ownership. And ownership meaning that a lot of times if you're in a school and maybe there's a special ed teacher and the special ed teacher says, oh, well, these are my students. And the general education teacher says, well, these are my students. Well, no, in really inclusive environments, there are no my students, your students. They're all our students. So that idea of ownership, meaning that every teacher feels that all students are, equally valued in the classroom, and that all students belong in the classroom. So there's that sense of ownership and that sense of students really feeling that they belong.
Just to kind of clarify then, for any, especially any men out there listening to this, this would be akin to having a conversation with your wife, but not watching the football game during that conversation, because you need to not only just be there, but you have to actually be in the conversation and a part of, correct?
Yes, that's a perfect analogy. I've not heard that one before, but I'm going to have to use that one, I think.
Feel free, yeah. No royalties charged.
Yeah. So that's perfect. So it's that idea of ownership, but also with that sense of belonging, also comes the idea of friendship, because you can't truly be part of a community unless you belong and have friendships, and more at just the surface level. So one of the definitions I saw was, the true test for an inclusive environment is if certain students are absent from the classroom, are they going to be missed? So is their lack of presence, is that going to be noticed by the other students? And if other students are noticing, hey, my friend Johnny's not here today, I really miss him, then you really have an inclusive environment, because not only are individuals with disabilities physically there, but they have friendships, they're valued by their classmates, and they're valued by their teachers, and they're not thought of as being a separate group of students from the rest of the class.
Now, that's interesting, because as a former principal and an administrator, what you're describing is one of the goals that so many principals have with their faculties. You do all of these different outside of school events, and the way you structure your meetings and your retreats and different things to try and build that sense of community. So you're not just the fourth grade teacher doing a job, but you're a valued member of a faculty who's doing something greater than each of the individual parts that make up that faculty. And so it's really just taking that mindset, that idea of saying this value, this inclusion, this connection that we're trying to make on one level, and putting it on a far more important level, which is the students who are in the building, no matter what they bring to the building in terms of academic need or academic ability.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you think too, it really makes sense, especially in our Lutheran settings and Christian settings, because isn't that really what God directs us to do and Jesus directs us to do in the Bible?
Absolutely.
With his, some of the Bible verses, like in, Mark 12, where it says, love your neighbor as yourself. That dictates, hey, people are of equal value. And the Bible verse, we love it at LSEM is that, fearfully and wonderfully made. And that's not just individuals with disabilities. That's all students, and all people. So like you said, you want to, use the gifts of the fourth grade teacher and the third grade teacher and, kind of come together in a school community. And it's the same thing with students. Even if they are, quote unquote labeled with a disability, they have unique gifts and, unique challenges as well, but all students have those. So it's also, valuing those strengths and exploring how we can help with those challenges for all students, not just those with disabilities. So I think in our settings too, we have that unique opportunity to tie it to the Bible with our students, and as you mentioned too, with our faculties, to really show that, hey, this inclusion really is a biblical principle that Jesus is telling us that we need to follow.
We're talking to Dr. Kara Bratton on the Lutheran Education Podcast, sponsored by Lutheran Special Education Ministries. And again, we're discussing inclusion and the importance of that when it comes to how we bring about relationships and build that sense of belonging for our students. Now, Kara, you've just completed months and months of research and interviews and conversations, and you've discussed this with a lot of principals around the country. what are some other things that that you heard as you talked with some of those principals, reasons why perhaps they don't want to be inclusive?
Well, I will be honest, the principals I talked to really gave me better examples of why they do want to be inclusive and more inclusive. I didn't, you know, just by chance, the principals I talked to didn't really give me a whole lot of reasons why not. They gave me some challenges they've had in kind of conveying that message to others and kind of getting buy-in from their school boards, from teachers and things like that. But as principals, they were really the ones kind of pushing this idea. And a couple examples that come to mind, I know one principal, he was using the example from Mark of the Bible verse, you know, let little children come to me and do not hinder them. You know, that Bible verse we all know. And, you know, he said in his mind, as he works to constantly improve special education services and the inclusive environment in his school, he uses that Bible verse because he said, well, Jesus said, let the little children come to me, not just those children and those children, you know, kind of like you're pointing fingers and picking and choosing and saying, well, I want that child and that child, but well, Jesus really didn't mean that child. Obviously, Jesus meant all of those children. So in his mind, if he's truly letting the little children come to him, he feels like as a principal, well, Jesus didn't handpick kids. I can't handpick kids either. This applies to all students. The other example, there was a principal who was sharing with me after a few years of them very, very systematically improving their inclusive practices and knowing that we have students with disabilities, we're taking care of their academic needs, but we really, again, we want that buy-in from everybody where we have this sense that students with disabilities are just as equally valued and really no different from other students in our classrooms. And this principal was telling me that one of the teachers of the middle school class came up to him and just happened that this teacher did not have any students who were quote unquote labeled in her classroom. And she expressed that she really saw a difference in that class from her previous classes because she felt like in previous classes she had where there were students with diagnosed disabilities, she felt that because of some of the practices the school had put in place, the other kids in her classroom were much more compassionate, much more empathetic. They had much better social skills because they really had the opportunity to practice those skills and build friendships with students who were, you know, maybe a little bit different from what they might typically see, and said, you know, I really wish I had a little more diversity in my classroom because I think my group of students this year is really lacking in some of those things. So I thought that was very interesting because sometimes I think principals and teachers are concerned about, well, if I have that student who doesn't have great social skills or who is, you know, perceived as being different in my classroom, well, they're going to get picked on. You know, what is that going to do to the classroom dynamic? And an example like that shows that, you know, it's really the opportunity for the opposite to happen, for all students to really develop those social skills and those friendship skills, all those skills we want them to have in our schools when the classrooms are more diverse.
Now, do you think that society plays a role in some of the difficulties that we have when it comes to inclusion? Because you read the newspaper, if they still print them, or you read articles online, or you see things on TV, and we have become a nation and a world of labels because labels are easy, labels are quick, and we can make blanket statements and have blanket beliefs based on a label. So if you vote a certain way, if you watch a certain television station, if you follow a certain sport, if you have a certain hobby, it's easy for us to be able to say, oh, well, that means you're insert the label here. Inclusion blows that up completely because if you're going to truly be inclusive, you're tossing the labels out the window. Do you think that that plays a role in some of the struggles that some of our educators have when it comes to really, truly being inclusive?
I really do. And again, I think, you know, labels, you know, can have their time and place. I heard one educator who's written books about inclusion, you know, talking about, you know, the idea that labels and qualifying for special education, you know, the purpose of that is really to, you know, allow them to have certain rights. You know, there are rights for students with disabilities, and those rights are important. But in terms of the education, those labels should not be what's driving the education of those students. And too many times it's easy, and I'll admit this too, you know, as I'm talking with teachers and they tell me, oh, I have a student with autism. I have that kind of preconceived idea in my head. Okay, I'm going to maybe see a child trouble with social skills, trouble making eye contact, trouble with comprehension. And that might be a starting point in my mind, but I think too many times, you know, labels can kind of be prohibitive to, you know, really driving what, looking at what the student needs as opposed to what that label is. And if you think about it this way, you know, okay, if you're looking at maybe a child who would be diagnosed with what would be considered an intellectual disability, you know, there are cutoffs for their IQ. Okay, if the IQ falls in this range, they're, you know, moderate to severe. So maybe you have a child who scores a, you know, 72 on an IQ test, and you have another child that scores a 69. Well, the law is going to tell you those two students qualify as different things. Well, really, are the needs of those two students necessarily so different because of that label?
Sure.
You know, it might be the case, might not be the case. So, you know, using those labels to kind of direct that can be very, it can overall hurt the student because we're making some assumptions about what the student can do and can't do. Obviously, I think a lot of people are catching on to this, you know, what they call making sure we're always using people first language if we are kind of, you know, depicting people with labels. Whereas people first language, instead of saying, oh, that autistic child or that dyslexic girl, we say, you know, a student with autism or a student with dyslexia. That again, that's just one component of, you know, many that make up who they are and their strengths. So we don't want that label to be the focus.
And that makes a lot of sense, Kara, because when you hear, I mean, it's a silly, simple thing, and someone may argue semantics, but autistic child, the first thing you hear is the disability. Autism is the first word coming out of your mouth, and so it sets a tone. It gives you a picture. And child is secondary, where by reversing it, obviously child with, person with, now you're putting, again, a placeholder, a value on the person, on the child. And again, you have a classroom of 25 children. This one happens to be a child with autism or whatever other learning disability. And the fear that I see personally with labels, and perhaps you can, you know, this is a good segue into our next topic here, is when you've got those labels, again, it becomes very easy to set preconceived notions and in many ways lower your expectations for that child. Well, we know that there's a concern here, so now we should expect something different or something less from that child, when in fact, the research seems to show that that's not the case. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And the wording you'll find in a lot of books and research on inclusion, they use the term presume competence. So a lot of times as educators, we, not by ill intent, but a lot of times we will do the opposite. We hear that a student has a disability and we say, oh, well, they're not going to be able to do this because they have a disability. They're only going to be able to do this. But if we presume competence, and they call this the least dangerous assumption. So the least dangerous assumption to make for the education of any child is to assume that they can achieve the same outcome as their peers in the classroom. We always want to make that our assumption if we don't have any evidence to the contrary. If we know that student, if a teacher's worked with that student for years and has some good ideas or, again, some good evidence that, well, okay, I might need to adjust this or this, then obviously we want to make accommodations and modifications for students as needed, but we don't want to do that if we don't know, if we're just assuming that they're not going to be able to do that without any information other than the fact that they are, you know, they qualify as a student with a certain disability.
If I could just interject, this is kind of reminiscent of an experience that many of us have had in school. So if you can't wrap your mind around what a child with autism might be experiencing or feeling, think back to a class that you had. Most of us have probably had this class, I know I did, where you walk in and the teacher or the professor begins the class by saying, I just want you to know that 99% of the students who've taken this course could not achieve an A. And they wear that like it's a badge of honor. You know, I've heard this like in advanced placement courses in high school, you know, a percentage of how many kids will fail the test, you know, on day one of class, you know, or in college, on day one of class, here's your syllabus and here's your discouragement that you're not going to pass or you're not going to achieve the grade that you want. And for myself, I hear that and right from the very beginning, why should I bother? Why should I try? I mean, you've already established here, before you even got to know me or assess anything that I can do or who I am, that I'm a B student at best. So I quit. It's discouraging. Yeah. It's not going to be a semester or a class that I'm going to thoroughly enjoy or like on most levels.
Yeah.
I can only imagine what that must be like for a child who that's every day.
Yeah. And if I can jump in with an example too, from just my own, you know, recent education, as you were, you know, giving that example too, it was perfect. One of my doctoral courses was advanced multivariate statistics, which to many people probably sounds like the worst college course imaginable. I loved it. That was by far my favorite course, other than writing my dissertation. Well, I think the first assignment I turned in, you know, I made some mistakes on that assignment, and the professor, the way the course was designed is you could submit kind of a rough draft of your assignment a couple of days before it was due, and you could get some feedback and make corrections. So I did that and thought I was making the right corrections, but I was not. I was not, you know, doing what that professor wanted. So, you know, got the grade, and it was not a perfect grade. It wasn't a horrible grade, but the professor's comments to me were like, "Well, I really wish you would have taken the time to review my feedback." And I thought, "Well, I did review your feedback. I obviously didn't do it correct." So in exchanging emails with the professor to, again, just make sure she realized, hey, I was listening to what you were saying. She said to me, you know, it's okay. You know, most of my students who have 4.0s going into this class will not have a 4.0 by the end of multivariate statistics. And to me, that said, oh no, I will have a 4.0 by the end of advanced multivariate statistics. But again, this was the first assignment. So making that assumption that because I didn't have it right down at that point, where she thought I should, you know, be a little bit higher in what I was turning in because I missed some component of the instruction in the book, that this is what was going to break my 4.0. And I did, I proved her wrong. I got an A in that course, but again, that idea that it's not just students with disabilities we do that to, you know, teachers do kind of take pride in that sometimes, that nope, this is what's going to break you. I think this is going to be too difficult for you.
So again, for you and I to sit here and talk about these old war stories of experiences that we had with an individual teacher, that's a frustration for us. But I can only imagine what a child must feel when every day that's what they're experiencing day after day. They're just wanting to be one of 25 in the group. And now all of a sudden, they're having to battle this concept on a daily basis.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of times when you read literature on inclusion, one of the things that's pointed out is that what that really does, it obviously creates a level of frustration, but it really places the burden on the student, you know, that's labeled with a disability. The burden is on them to, quote unquote, prove that they belong in that classroom. You know, they have to prove that their academic skills are close enough to their peers that they can benefit from being in the classroom with them. Whereas other students in that fourth grade room or that third grade room, they don't have to prove that, you know, they belong there. They're there because they're 8 years old and that's the appropriate grade level, or, you know, they completed second grade, they go to third grade. But yet that burden is often placed on students with disabilities. And I don't think it's, you know, it's not ill-intended. You know, teachers want the best for those students. But assuming that, okay, until you prove you can, you know, be close enough in academic performance to your peers, you're going to go over here for your reading instruction. So we kind of need to rethink that whole idea of putting the burden on the student to prove that they've earned a spot in the classroom. And that's really what a truly inclusive environment, that burden of proof does not fall on the student.
And we're going to take a look at some of the ways that we can do that as we continue the conversation here with Dr. Kara Bratton on the Lutheran Education Podcast. But first, we're going to take just a short break to hear a message from Lutheran Special Education Ministries. You are listening to the Lutheran Education Podcast, brought to you by LSEM.
Lutheran Special Education Ministries is an organization committed to serving schools, churches, and families to advance the success of children who have learning needs. Our commitment to this mission began with the opening of the Lutheran School for the Deaf in Detroit. Over the years, our ministry has expanded, and today LSEM is proud to serve in Lutheran schools across the country. But as our ministry has grown, our commitment to helping students succeed academically in an environment where they can also grow spiritually is as strong as ever. So if your church or school is looking for professional development for your faculty, information to share with struggling families, or for a ministry partner to support an existing resource room or start a new one, LSEM is ready to help you meet your specialized learning goals. For more information about how LSEM can help you build brighter futures for your students, please contact us at 248-419-3390 or visit our website at www.luthsped.org. That's www.luthsped.org.
And welcome back to the Lutheran Education Podcast, sponsored by Lutheran Special Education Ministries. We're joined once again by Dr. Kara Bratton, Director of Special Education here at LSEM, and we're talking about inclusion and the importance of truly having inclusion in a Lutheran school, in any school, where you're dealing with students with special needs. Kara, when we took our break, we were just talking about this idea of presuming competence, and I really love that phrase that you had, the least dangerous assumption, making sure that you're not assuming that students can't do things, and then, of course, labeling them and creating that deficit, but being more positive in terms of how you view the students. So what are some ways that teachers can do that more effectively? What are some tips that you would give them as they try to be more positive and less dangerous in their assumptions?
Well, one of the ways, and we already touched on this a little bit, but is even just with the language that's used. I mean, we talked about using people first language. But one of the a little cartoon I've seen floating around, you know, shows a woman approaching a man who's in a wheelchair, and she said, you know, what do you prefer to be called? You know, physically challenged, handicapped, disabled, you know, what do you prefer to be called? And his response is, Joe would be fine. So even just that language of why, you know, why does it have to, you know, talking about a student, why does that language have to include their disability? And I think sometimes as a teacher or as a professional in education, we might think, oh, well, that differentiates that student from another, without realizing that what that's really doing is it's separating those students. It's separating that student from others in the classroom. So even something as simple as that, even as we're talking with our professional peers, but you know, getting away from including those labels in our conversation. It's Joe, or if you need to say Joe Smith to separate them from, you know, Joe Miller, that's okay. But it doesn't have to be, oh, Joe, the one with autism. I think one of the other strategies, and you see this a lot of times, you know, in meetings and you hear that idea, or in case conferences for students of, you know, always start with the strengths. Well, that's, you know, that's a good idea. But, you know, if you think about it this way, in terms of thinking about an inclusion, if I say to you, okay, here's a 12-year-old boy with an intellectual disability that functions at about the age of 5, he reads at a pre-kindergarten level and can write his name 60% of the time and most of his ABCs with only with assistance. Okay, that gives you some pretty clear ideas about what that student can do. It also gives you a lot of preconceived ideas about, what am I going to do with that student in my classroom? Now, if I describe a student and say, the student is a 12-year-old boy who participates with his whole class, he loves small group reading discussions, he's enthusiastic about learning, his peers like him, and he works well in cooperative learning groups. Okay, if you're a teacher, which student are you going to be like, oh yeah, that's a student who's going to do well in my class? Student A?
It's the second one, obviously, because again, there's less to worry about. There are fewer things in there that's going to, for the teacher, say, wow, that's going to be extra work that I'm going to have to do. And yeah, again, not to sound negative or to be accusatory of anybody, but we have a lot of teachers who tend to look at students in those terms. You know, what is this going to mean for me when it comes to the work I need to do? Wouldn't we all like to have 25 perfect children who we can just plug and play and move on? Of course, if we did, it'd be 25 Teddy Ruxpins. And who wants a classroom full of Teddy Ruxpins? That's kind of creepy. Sorry.
Right.
just kind of blame it on COVID, but just the mind just kind of went toward that. I've been in the house too long. But no, yeah. Back to your point. Obviously, the second description is one that is more welcoming. It doesn't change the statistical information that was in the first one, but it certainly brings a human nature to this child. And again, right, to go back to the biblical basis that you brought up earlier, this is one of those cases where, again, knowing that information is going to be critical, because during those days when we do have to do that extra work, because this is a 12-year-old who's reading at a 5-year-old's level, that's going to be work. And in order to do that work, having that bigger picture and that greater connection, that stronger bond, that's got to be huge in terms of being able to be successful in that area.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So for those of you that didn't catch on, both of those descriptions, we were talking about the exact same student. But that idea of when you focus on the strengths, it doesn't mean when we set goals for that student, we're not going to set goals to work on some of those things that are challenging. But how different would those goals be if you only heard that first part and not the second part? Your goals would end up being different, I can guarantee you. So if you really are working with that child's strengths and not just focusing on that disability, you know, that category or the disability label. Again, we talked earlier about how that disability label shouldn't be what drives instruction. It shouldn't be what drives student need. That just legally allows them access to some different rights, but that doesn't dictate what that instruction should be. So making just those changes in how we talk about students and how we think about students might not seem like a lot, but it really makes a difference in that whole idea of presuming competence and, you know, trying to help students push them to meet higher goals. And, you know, research will show us that when we set those high expectations, you know, over and over again, students with disabilities will do better when we set those high expectations for them and presume competence.
So Kara, when someone looks at the two descriptions that you just gave of that student and says, well, both can be true, but if you just focus on the second one, then you're glossing over the realities. You know, you're choosing to be general and not being specific. What would your response be to somebody who's going to come back with that kind of a counter argument to the point you've just made?
Well, I would say first, you know, obviously that example is meant to kind of show the extreme, we do need to balance both those things. You know, we need to balance the strengths of the students with the things that might be challenging, because it doesn't mean that we don't address the things that are challenging. We want to address those. So we need that combination. But knowing that, hey, say this student in the example, you know, works well with his peers, loves discussion. Okay, how can we incorporate those things into working on some of his reading skills? So that the reading skills aren't just taught in isolation. Or again, if this is a student who loves being around his peers, learns well from his peers, and then we pull him out of that setting to teach him those skills, okay, could those skills be learned better in the setting with his peers? So it's kind of having to, you know, start with the strengths and then, you know, working the conversation toward what some of the challenges are. But starting with those strengths in mind helps us keep in mind, okay, this is going to be maybe a better way to help with some of those challenges when we know what the student's specific strengths are. Because that's, you know, one thing we don't always think of when we think of a disability label. You know, we think of the things that are typically a challenge, but we don't always think about the associated strengths. So just kind of starting the conversation there so that we can set goals and figure out how best to help with the challenges.
I have to admit that there's a biblical connection that pops into my head when I hear this. You know, that story of Jesus when he was at the well, and that woman came out to the well in the middle of the day when none of the other women were there, for reasons that we come to find out are, well, she's been kind of ostracized from society because of some of her choices. And what's amazing about that story is, as Jesus is talking with her, he's not talking with her in terms of negativity. He's not talking to her in terms of judging per se. His initial conversations with her are as they should be. You know, him talking to a woman, there's courtesy, there's politeness, there's concern. But it doesn't mask the fact that he knows her backstory. And as they start discussing things, he makes it very clear to her, yeah, I know your backstory. But that wasn't the purpose. The purpose was to connect with her, to share that love with her, and to be able to correct some of those things that she was making in her life, to point them out, and to then give her the opportunity to go ahead and change those things, which, again, you know, that's the joy of law and gospel. You know, we have to see our sin to be able to know we need a savior. In this particular case, we need to see the child for all of the things that they are. And again, wouldn't you rather know that in spite of some of the challenges that you're going to face working with this child, well-liked by peers, enthusiastic about learning, cooperative? I mean, those are huge things. A lot of the teachers that work for LSEM, as we talk to them, will tell us, give me a student who's got challenges and a mindset to work, and we can go anywhere. But it's those students who don't want to work, who are looking for ways to avoid, those are the ones that become very frustrating situations very quickly. And it has nothing to do with ability. It has everything to do with the energy and the attitude that they bring into it. So seems to me like having that information fills the picture in, and again, becomes the fuel that's going to drive many teachers to be able to lead these children to greater levels of success.
Absolutely. And you know, this doesn't just apply to students that teachers might know have an identified disability. You know, it's just good practice to be thinking about all students that way. Because, you know, you will have students who aren't quote unquote labeled, but you know that they're struggling with something that's not identified. And I talk to a lot of teachers that, you know, a lot of times might be looking for an evaluation to answer those questions. And sometimes it might be appropriate, but sometimes it's also a matter of what's that evaluation going to tell you that you can't see in the classroom. I had a consultation with a teacher, and we were talking about a student who, I'm not a diagnostician, but I believe that student would likely qualify as a student on the autism spectrum, but was not diagnosed. But talking to this teacher about some of the things he was doing in the classroom already, you know, some of the strategies he'd used, some that were effective, some that weren't effective. And you know, then the conversation came back to, you know, he asked me, well, do you think the student is on the autism spectrum? And I said, I can't say, I'm not a diagnostician. But he followed that up with then saying, well, I don't know how to work with students with autism. I said, well, you just spent half an hour telling me about all the wonderful things you were doing when you didn't know if the student had autism or not. So again, that's what I tried to, you know, talk to him about, that label doesn't change the fact that either that strategy worked or it didn't work. So continue doing the things that work, whether that student has autism or not. You know, that wasn't the important thing, but in his mind, well, I'm not qualified to work with a student with autism. I said, you just showed me that you are.
Amazing how that label just changed the mindset and his confidence level of working with a child. I know how to work with kids, but I don't know how to work with this diagnosis. What an interesting story.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, that, you know, the mindset, you know, that's important for students, but it's also, you know, important for teachers as well. You know, the mindset that our students have, and whether they're going to be successful or not, you know, our teachers can have that same mindset of, well, I can't be a good teacher to a student with this disability. But if you think, okay, but I can be a good teacher to Johnny because I know Johnny. I know what he's good at, and I also know what some of his challenges are. So I can effectively teach him. And I know teachers underestimate their ability because they do get caught up sometimes in those labels, you know, in thinking, well, I'm only qualified to educate students who kind of fit in this box. I'm not qualified to work with these other students.
We're discussing inclusion with Dr. Kara Bratton here on the Lutheran Education Podcast. So again, how you begin your conversations and how you view your students and how you view yourself working with your students, all good tips. Anything else that that you would offer as far as advice to teachers when it comes to helping their students be successful in an inclusive environment?
Well, I think one of the other things we talked earlier about, you know, one of the important Bible verses to LSEM being that, you know, that from the Psalms, you know, that each child is fearfully and wonderfully made. And we talk a lot about that. But I think that's an important thing that we can carry out in our classroom with all of our students too, you know, helping them to understand student differences. But not from a point of, again, saying, oh, well, you know, Johnny over here has autism, so this is what we need to do for him. Please do not do that. Whatever you take from this, do not do that. But one of the ideas I've read is, you know, again, along with that fearfully and wonderfully made idea is, depending on the age of the student, you can either kind of have little, like, keys, like house keys printed out. For older students, you also might use like a picture of the brain. And so for younger students, I've seen it done this way, where you know, you can hold up a couple different keychains, say, okay, this is my keychain or key ring, you know, that's full of different keychains, that's full of different keys. Well, okay, here are some of the keys that are important to me. I have my house key, I have a key to my office, I have a key to my car. Well, everyone's key ring is going to look different. Everyone's going to have different keys. So talk to them too about, okay, you know, just like, you know, everyone's key ring might be different. What are some of the keys that we have in this classroom? You know, okay, if we're in a classroom of 8-year-olds, well, most of us have a key that says, you know, we can read. You know, we could read the words on the page. Most of us have a key that says we know how to do our math facts. Most of us have a key that says, I know how to say I'm sorry to my friend and I forgive you to my friend. But then, you know, talk about that, you know, God gives us those keys at different times and for different purposes. We don't, our key rings don't always have all the exact same keys at the exact same times. So sometimes we're waiting as an 8-year-old for God to give us that key that unlocks the part of our brain that helps us read better or helps us be a better friend. And that's okay. That doesn't mean that makes us better or worse. It just means that God is giving, hasn't developed that skill in us yet. So you don't have to talk about that in terms of, you know, disabilities or, you know, picking out certain students, but getting all students to identify, hey, what are the keys that God's already given you on your key ring? And then talk about, you know, what are some of those keys you want by the end of the year? What keys do you hope God puts on your key ring by the end of the year? And maybe for some students, you know, who are maybe more advanced, maybe they're, you know, want to learn long division as an 8-year-old, you know, whereas there's other 8-year-olds who, you know, they just hope that maybe they have that key that, you know, helps them play with their friends on the playground, you know, without getting into an argument, you know, or things like that. So activities like that can really, you know, help students, you know, see that, you know what, God gave all of us strengths and differences and unique challenges, you know, but that's how God designed us. He designed us that way and with a purpose. So I think, again, in our schools, I always come back to this, that this is just a benefit of working in our Lutheran schools and in our Christian environments. We have to bring it back to those Bible verses and what God tells us and what Jesus has demonstrated for us in the Bible and try to live out those principles and teach students how to implement that in their daily interactions with their peers.
And I think what you're saying here with the keys is really great in Lutheran schools, as you've just pointed out, if I can piggyback onto that, because I was teaching at Concordia University in Ann Arbor, in one of the foundations courses, we would use some scenes from, the Ron Clark story. And I don't know if you've ever seen the movie, Matthew mm-hmm. Perry from Friends plays Ron Clark. And again, very inspirational, great look at how here's a guy who decided to go help the students that he felt were in the greatest need of his help. And what he was teaching them wasn't strictly reading, writing, science, social studies, but it was life skills beyond the classroom sorts of things that he recognized that these students needed, but were equally as important. In Lutheran schools, we can go one step further, because while he could work on the academic and the emotional and the social aspects, we have the spiritual component that's right there in front of us as well. And to have those keys to be able to say, I'm going to teach you not only how to be a good citizen, a good student, but a believer, a person who lives by faith, who understands who Jesus is, and can then share that faith. What a great example. And again, most of that has little to do with lesson planning, has little to do with state standards and benchmarks and all those other things that we tend to focus a lot of our time on academically and have a level of importance for sure. But what a greater level of connectivity. And when you can do those things, when you can share with your students in a devotion or in a chapel or in a song or in an interaction on the playground. Those are the things that I think children, as they grow older, remember and look back on with a greater fondness, and it helps the rest of those academic things stick. Do you personally remember any of the English that your third grade teacher taught you? My guess is if you think back to third grade, you're thinking of some other interaction that you had with him or her that built community, that built a relationship. That's probably the point that sticks. And then some of those other lessons that you may have learned kind of hinge off of that. But the critical thing is that emotional piece, that connectivity piece, and the circle of friends concept is a huge component to that, I would think.
Yeah. And to, you know, an example that made me think of one of an author I've read a lot about and heard speak on inclusion. She does this activity with the participants, and she says, you know, think about a student you either currently have or you had in the past. You know, think about that student. What made that student pop into your head? And then write down if you could teach that student, or what's the one skill you want that student to have that will impact the rest of their lives. What would that skill be? What would that one thing be? And so, you know, all the educators, you know, they take a minute and they, you know, they're writing down their thoughts. And, you know, she had it integrated with technology, so everything was popping up on the screen as people were typing it. And I can tell you the number of times you saw the skill, oh, I wish they could learn their multiplication facts. I wish they could, you know, do an academic skill. Like you said, it all came back to those other skills. You know, what's that one thing that will impact the rest of their lives, that will change their life for the better going forward? And not to say that the academic skills aren't important, but that's not necessarily, if you could pick that one thing. And I think a lot of times this wasn't in a Christian setting, you know, or a Christian speaker, but I think a lot of times for our students, it would come back to that. If we could let them walk away with one thing that's going to change their life, it's that belief in Jesus and in their faith. But there could also be some other components in there, but I would bet that 99% of the people listening would not pick an academic skill if they could, you know, pinpoint that one skill that would change the lives of their students going forward.
Absolutely. And take that one step further in terms of the great benefit that we as Christian teachers have. We've got the Bible at our disposal that we can use as a teaching tool. You know, think of all of these great citizenship things that schools try to teach, and all the programs that they come up with to try and teach them and to do such a great job with that. And then as a Christian teacher, just look at the fruits of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, self-control. Wow, one verse, that's a pretty good list. And you on the public school side of things are probably paying hundreds of dollars for somebody who came up with a program that more or less took those eight components and stripped the biblical side of it to be able to make it palatable for a more broad audience apart from the religious side of things. So again, what a wonderful opportunity we have, but also a responsibility that we have to be able to make those things be at the focus with the academics that we're also providing to the kids. Safety, security, especially in this year of pandemic and remote learning and all of the ups and downs that we've had, those are some foundational pieces that I think are going to serve our students very well into their adult lives, because they saw it witnessed by men and women of faith in their classrooms each day.
Yeah, and one of the principals that I interviewed for my dissertation, kind of bringing that back to the idea of inclusion and special education, you know, was talking about, and I think most principals would probably acknowledge this as well, but she talked about during the, you know, admissions and enrollment process that she's, you know, sitting down and meeting with parents and talking about, okay, what, you know, again, what are the strengths of the child? What are some of the needs of the child? And she said, you know what, sometimes those needs are the determining factor, She said, but it, you know, it's really easy to say, well, they can get this need met and this need met in the public school, and maybe they can't get those academic needs met here. But she said, but maybe they get different needs met here. They could get needs met here that they're never going to get in the public schools. Again, because of that faith, because of that Christian environment. And I know principals want to make the right decision, but so many times it's, you know, those decisions are focused too much on the academics. And again, that idea that students have to prove that, well, I can function in this third grade classroom, but it could be that, you know, their academic goals or academic achievement might be different, but that's okay. You know, they're a lot of times going to get so much more overall from the other parts of our environment in that Christian teaching than maybe they would get in a public school. And that doesn't mean that decision is easy or a very black and white, well, you know, these students need to be in the public school to get services, or, you know, that the Christian message outweighs the academics. Those are obviously individual, you know, family and school decisions, but just that point that, again, to what you were saying, that sometimes what can be offered in our Lutheran schools is it's more than just the academic. And we need to remember that too when we're talking about children with disabilities and inclusion.
Excellent. And I think that's a great place to end that conversation, to leave that point. So if we've got folks who are listening, teachers, administrators who want more information about how they could do a better job of making their schools inclusive, or just wanted more information about LSCM and its programs, how would they go ahead and reach out to get in contact with you, Kara?
So the easiest way is through our website, which is luthsped.org, luthsped.org. And there you will find contact information and some basic information about LSEM in general. But my specific email is kbratton, that's kbratton, at luthsped.org. So feel free to email me there. I will also put a plug in. This year, we have done a series of articles on inclusion in the LCMS school mailings. So if you get those mailings, check those out on the LCMS school ministry site, and look for those monthly articles about inclusion that give some more specific tips and tricks for how to make your school more inclusive.
Kara, thank you so much for the time. I really do appreciate having a chance to talk. We talk all the time on a lot of different topics, but it's always fun to just sit down with you on the podcast here and discuss an area of special education, an area of education that will really benefit our teachers. And your knowledge, your research, your work, very valuable. And so thank you very much for your willingness to share it with our audience today.
Absolutely. Thank you for inviting me on to talk about this.
And thanks to all of you for tuning in and listening to the Lutheran Education Podcast. We appreciate the opportunity to be able to share these things with you. And again, if there's ever anything that you can need from us, feel free to reach out to us by our website, luthsped.org. Thank you again, Dr. Kara Bratton. I'm Richard Schumacher. Have a wonderful rest of your day, and we'll catch you next time on the Lutheran Education Podcast, sponsored by Lutheran Special Education Ministries. I know you know
me. Thank you for listening to the Lutheran Education Podcast, brought to you by Lutheran Special Education Ministries. To hear future episodes, please subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. For more information on this episode's topic or any other questions regarding Lutheran education or Lutheran Special Education Ministries, please feel free to contact us at 248-419-3390 or visit our website at www.luthsped.org. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.